Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Pope Benedict opens the Year of Faith as he celebrates Mass marking the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Second Vatican Council. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, addresses the Synod and speaks to Vatican Radio about his decade as head of the Worldwide Anglican Communion. And one of the seven US bishops attending the Synod shares with us why he sees charity and justice at the heart of the new evangelization. Thursday, October the 11th, marked the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Second Vatican Council. And to celebrate that event, Pope Benedict XVI was joined by bishops from around the world in St. Peter's Square for a Mass and official opening of a Year of Faith. Some 20,000 people packed into the square to hear the Pope speak about the need for new evangelization, an even greater need today, he said, than half a century ago. The Pope said in that time a spiritual desertification has been spreading around the world. Yet all around us, he added, we see numerous signs of thirst for God. My colleague Susie Hodges takes a closer look at what the Pope had to say.
Referring to the Year of Faith, Pope Benedict described it as a pilgrimage in the desert of the contemporary world, in which the only essential thing to carry along is the gospel and the faith of the Church, of which the documents of the Second Vatican Council are a shining expression, along with a catechism of the Catholic Church. He went on to say that during the Council there was a dynamic effort regarding the common task of making the truth and beauty of our faith shine again in our times, without sacrificing it to the needs of the present or holding it tied to the past.
Per questo ho più volte insistito sulla necessità di ritornare, per così dire, alla lettera del Concilio, cioè.
It's for this reason, the Pope continued, that I have often insisted on the need to return, as it were, to the letter of the Council, that is, its documents, to find its authentic spirit. By referring to the documents, we avoid the extremes of anachronistic nostalgia or racing ahead, and are able to pick the novelty within the continuity. The Council, the Pope said, did not formulate anything new in matters of faith, nor did it wish to replace what was ancient. Rather, it concerned itself with seeing that the same faith might continue to be lived in the present day, that it might remain a living faith in a world of change. But, as the Pope reminded those present, the Council Fathers were able to do that because they were sure of their faith and the solid rock on which it was based. Instead, he added, in the years following the Council, many people blindly followed the prevailing mentality, putting into question the very pillars of the depository of the faith. Pope Benedict concluded his homily by entrusting the Year of Faith to the Mother of God, whom, he said, shines like a star on the path of the new evangelization. I'm Susie Hodges.
Among those attending the anniversary Mass in St. Peter's Square were representatives of many other Christian churches, highlighting once again the important impact that Vatican II had on the ecumenical movement. The ecumenical patriarch Bartholomew of Constantinople, plus other Orthodox leaders, and the Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, took part in the celebrations and were given a special welcome by Pope Benedict
XVI. Il mio saluto a tutti voi, in particolare a Sua Santità Bartolomeo I, Patriarca di Costantinopoli, e a Sua Grazia Rowan Williams, Arcivescovo di Canterbury.
Dr. Rowan Williams, who'll be stepping down from his leadership position as head of the Worldwide Anglican Communion at the end of this year, also addressed the Synod of Bishops on Wednesday, sharing some of his thoughts on the importance of contemplation for a new evangelization and the journey towards fuller Christian unity. I caught up with the Archbishop earlier in the day at the Church of St. Gregory on the Caelian Hill to take a look back at his decade in office and to hear his views on the current state of Anglican-Catholic dialogue. Archbishop Rowan Williams, you're here in the Church of St. Gregory the Great, the place where it all began, in a sense, for the English Church. And yet, this place is an increasingly important place of encounter today, isn't it, beyond its historical significance?
Very much so. I think one of the great things that's happened in the last few years is how this place has opened up to Anglican pilgrims. And I know that the hope is that the Chapel of St. Gregory will be somewhere where Anglican pilgrims will want to come and remind themselves of their origins. Just a couple of weeks ago, I was in the Library of Corpus Christi in Cambridge, holding in my hands again the Augustine Gospels, the Gospels that came with St. Augustine in 597 to Britain. And that was another really vivid recollection of how things began here.
It's also a place where you've had a number of meetings with popes, isn't it?
Well, I was privileged to be with Pope Benedict here earlier this year to celebrate the millennium of the Camaldolese for a very moving service of evening prayer. And the friendship that we've developed with the community here has become very important to me.
You're also here marking the Synod and the 50th anniversary of Vatican II. How important do you think was that council for those outside of the Catholic Church?
It was enormously important. I was a teenager as the council began, and an Anglican, a practicing Anglican. And what had been a very, apparently very self-contained, rather remote, exotic, fascinating, but slightly strange body suddenly opened up. And I think that was the effect that it had for me and for others. We could see the workings. Instead of looking at an institution that was very visibly confident that it was sufficient to itself, we saw people beginning to say, well, does it have to be like this? We saw a transparency in the Roman Catholic Church, which, of course, because it was so deeply connected with the personality of Pope John the 23rd, which was a gift to all Christians, became something, yes, deeply stirring. It's because of the Second Vatican Council, I think, that other churches began to rethink some of their own ways of doing things. It's because of the liturgical reform there that I think liturgical reform was accelerated in other contexts. So, yes, hugely important for the rest of us.
It was, of course, also a watershed moment for ecumenism, and yet, despite so much progress, the deepening of relationships, new friendships, that journey seems to be struggling today in a way that was hardly imaginable a few decades ago, especially the Anglican-Catholic dialogue. Are you in any way disappointed that there hasn't been more in terms of tangible results for the dialogue during your time here?
Sometimes, of course, yes, I feel that disappointment. But on the other hand, I look back at the 60s and remember, of course, we believed anything was possible in the 60s, whether in church or in politics or in international relations. And there was a certain haste and a certain naivety about all that. What abides, of course, and what we can't go back on, is the fact that we pray together in a quite different way now. In the 50s, when I was a child, it would have been quite unthinkable to pray alongside Roman Catholics. And of course, in those days, even saying the Lord's Prayer together was frowned upon. So the gain in terms of simply understanding ourselves as in some way belonging together, that's irreversible. Now, of course, it would have been wonderful if we've been able to take rather more steps towards something really visible, really concrete in terms of mutual recognition. But both the Roman Catholic and the Anglican families have changed, have developed in that period in ways that have sometimes made that more difficult. And that's reality. We don't, when we change, always wait for one another. And that's a fact of our community life, I think.
Would you say, though, that ecumenism is still a priority for the Church of England today, with so many other, apparently, more pressing problems and internal divisions?
I'm tempted to say unity is indivisible, which is a ridiculous logical statement. But what I mean is, if we're interested about the unity of our own church, which we certainly ought to be, then there's no way of not being interested in unity more widely. The real issue is, what does it mean to be the Church of God? Not to be this or that little religious society, but what does it mean to be the Church of God? That's the question we're asking within the Anglican family. That's the question we have to ask across denominational boundaries. And that's why, even if ecumenism in the sort of 50s, 60s, 70s sense of lots of institutional meetings and negotiations doesn't always feel like the same level of priority. Unity has to be a priority.
One of the big difficulties, of course, that has been a stumbling block between the two communities is the question of ordaining women bishops within the Church of England. Last time we met, you were optimistic that there would be a solution on this before the end of your mandate. Do you still hope that within the next couple of months that you can find a solution acceptable to everybody within the Church of England?
We won't find a solution acceptable to everybody in the Church of England. That would be a real miracle of the last days, I think. But what the bishops have been working at with a good deal of blood, sweat and tears in the last few months is trying to find that point of balance which is just generous enough to the minority and just clear enough about the principle not to alienate more than we're bound to. I'm very struck by the fact that the bishops in their recent meeting were almost unanimous in finding this what they wanted to recommend to the church. So it's for us now to commend it to the Church of England at the Synod next month, and we'll see. But a great deal of work and prayer has gone into this. I'm certainly hopeful still that all that work won't be wasted, all that prayer won't be wasted, that we'll find something which allows us to go forward honouring everybody within our fellowship.
Here in the Vatican, you're talking to the Synod of Bishops about the importance of contemplation if we want to be credible witnesses to the world. You talk about it as the key to prayer, to liturgy, to art, to ethics. Why do you see this as so central to the new evangelisation?
If evangelisation is just rallying the troops or just trying to get people to sign up, something's missing. And what's missing is the transformed humanity that the gospel brings to us. And as I see it, contemplation is the centre for our understanding of what the new humanity is. That is a humanity that is unconditionally receptive to God, unconditionally receptive to grace, and therefore profoundly open to what God is giving, willing to live with the darkness and risk that that sometimes entails, conscious all the time of being anchored in, well, in the Son's contemplation of the Father and the eternal mystery of the Trinity. That's the new humanity, and that is what excites me about the contemplative vision. So if we're going to talk about a transformed humanity, I think we will need that element in it.
Somehow this focus on contemplation sounded a little to me like a sign of relief that you'll be able to have a little more time, perhaps, for contemplation now than you have had over the past decade. What would you say have been the hardest challenges, perhaps, that you've had to face as the Archbishop of Canterbury, and what are you most looking forward to as you step down from the post?
Well, I could take a long time talking about moments of challenge. I think just the awareness that with almost every significant decision in the Church of England and in the Communion, you are going to alienate certain people, you're going to lose friends, literally lose friends, that there are things that have to be done which may be right or inevitable, but don't feel particularly good at the time. It's watching the costs to others of decisions that have to be made. We were discussing just this week the Lambeth Conference of 2008 and the decisions made not to issue invitations to certain bishops whose election had been, or consecration had been, against the direct counsel of the wider communion. And that felt like both an inevitable thing to honour commitments we had declared together and also a very, very hard and un-kingdom-like thing to be doing. It's those things that are the tough memories. I don't imagine that what lies ahead will be conflict-free or straightforward, but I do look forward to the chance of doing a little bit more joined-up thinking and writing and seeing what service to the church I can give in this new environment.
You famously said that your successor needs the constitution of an ox and the hide of a rhinoceros. What positive practical advice would you like to give to the man who'll be shortly stepping into your shoes?
Visit lots of schools and parishes. Make sure that you're there constantly, faithfully, regularly, with people who are doing what matters. One of the great illusions you can have in a job like this is that what you do in the office is what really matters. And, well, God deliver us from an illusion like that. What really matters, of course, is lives evolving in faithful discipleship at the grassroots. So go and see that happening. Go and encourage it. Go and learn from it. Go and be vitalised by it. I've enormously appreciated the time I've spent, especially in schools, because being with young people who are questioning about their faith and their life is always invigorating. And for all the difficulties that beset many parishes, I can't think of any parish I've visited in 20 years as a bishop that hasn't in some way made me go away feeling it's all worthwhile.
Finally, you'll be having a private meeting with Pope Benedict the 16th to say your goodbyes to him. Can you share with us anything of what you'll be talking to him about?
I imagine we'll talk a little bit about the synod, about the new evangelization, and I hope that we can look back a little bit on where we are as communions after the last 10 years. Doubtless some of the questions that we've touched on here will be around, but I think mostly it'll be an occasion for me to express gratitude for the welcome and the warmth I've always received here.
My thanks there to the outgoing Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams. Seven US bishops are amongst the Synod Fathers presenting their views on new evangelization to the gathering, which continues through until the end of this month. In their presentations so far, they've reflected on many of the challenges they face in the US today, from the problems of globalization and immigration to the need for a new Pentecost, the rediscovery of the sacrament of penance, and the key role of Catholic social teaching in bringing people back to the church. That question of the importance of works of charity and justice at the heart of the Church's mission was explored by Bishop Gerald Kikanis of Tucson, chairman of Catholic Relief Services. I talked to him about the task of rediscovering this rich heritage of Catholic social teaching.
Well, I think every human being is going to ask the basic human questions. Who am I? Where have I come from? Where am I going? What is the best way to live my life? Those are very fundamental human questions. And despite the rise of secularism, people still have to wonder about who they are and where they're going and what is a fulfilling way to live their lives. So I think these core spiritual questions do sustain despite changes in culture, despite changes in circumstances. And it's important to find ways for the church to address those questions that people have. Sometimes people say that the hardware of the church doesn't mesh with the software of people's lives, that their questions are not being responded to or heard in a way that is connecting with them.
Is that a reasonable assessment, do you think?
I think to some extent it is, that we do need, as Blessed John Paul said, new ardor, new methods, new expressions. And I think what that's saying is that we do have to find better ways to articulate our faith and the value of faith in people's lives. It's not enough simply to mouth the same messages. We need to frame our message in a way that is going to address the questions people have.
Are you bringing here to the Synod some suggestions of ways in which the Church should be updating this software, as you call it?
What I hope to speak about at the Synod is the importance of works of charity and justice as fundamental to the new evangelization. I think it's when people see the good the Church is doing, when people experience the love that the Church is presenting and sharing with the world, that this is the most powerful way that people will be able to encounter the Lord, because they begin to ask, why are these people doing this? Why are they interested in being of help to us? Why are they wanting to be of service? And so that will be my focus and my intervention, is the value and importance of works of charity and justice in the new evangelization.
You're chairman of Catholic Relief Services, which does just that. And yet somehow this image, this powerful image, as you say, of the Church reaching out to help all those in any kind of need, doesn't get through to the public imagination, does it?
Well, I think it does in some circumstances, and perhaps part of it is we haven't witnessed strongly enough and clearly enough the importance of the work of the humanitarian outreach of the Church. I know I was in Baghdad some time ago for Catholic Relief Services and visiting some of the clinics and some of the places that livelihood preparation is being developed for mostly Muslim people. And We went into the clinic and there was a banner of the Holy Family, and they explained to us that this was a gift from the Muslim community to Caritas Iraq because of the good that they were doing for others, a recognition that somehow their faith made a difference to why they were doing this work, and the Muslim community wanted to recognize that. I think that's a little glimmer of how works of charity can really impact the lives of others. So, yes, I think we do need to communicate our message more, to draw our Catholics into the work of service. You know, one of our board members at CRS said she never understood what the church was doing around the world, and it has strengthened her faith. It has deepened her faith, her appreciation of what her church is teaching about the dignity of all human life. So I think when people come closer to the work of the church and actually experience this, this is why one of the things CRS is doing is trying to work with seminaries and colleges and universities so that young people actually become a part of the work of the church in its outreach to the poor around the world. And I don't know any young person that comes back from those experiences not having changed, not having seen life in a really a different way, and having their faith nurtured by the fact that the church is doing so much good.
This is certainly central to your vision of the church. There are some who say that perhaps works of justice and peace are no longer seen as central to the church's message as they were perhaps a few decades ago.
Well, I think this, of course, is a serious misunderstanding of what the faith is about. You know, there are some who begin to question and challenge the church's social teaching and social doctrine, and yet it's endemic to all that the church says about human life that flows from our faith and belief in God. So I think it's a huge mistake for the church to walk away from what is central to the work. And, you know, it was quite inspiring to me yesterday to hear our Holy Father, of course, this is an aging man, but with the vim and vigor that he presented his reflection to the synod just as we began in the prayer. And it's interesting that he chose to speak of these two words, our confession and charity, and that the two go hand in hand. We have to profess our faith, but we also have to live our faith. And we have to profess our faith with more courage, and we have to live our faith with greater commitment, especially to those who are struggling. You know, his phrase from Caritas in Veritate has always moved me. We have to be people with hearts that see where love is needed, and respond. And I think that has been so central to the message of the church and to the life of the church. I mean, we look at the saints and their commitment to the poor and to the needy. This has been an inspiration for the church. Martyrs are an inspiration, but also those invested in the work of the poor are inspirations for people and ways by which people come to know the Lord.
And we have some new saints coming up, don't we, during this synod?
Yes, of course, Marianne Cope with St. Damien and Molokai, a marvelous example of someone who was willing to give her life for others, which is always an inspiration. And Kateri Tekawitha is, of course, very important to us in the Southwest. While she was from Canada, she was someone who has had a tremendous impact on the Native American communities. And I know some of our people from Tucson are coming with great enthusiasm for that event. It's amazing how communities of faith are inspired by leaders of faith, witnesses of faith. And certainly these seven saints will bring out many people who have been inspired by their lives. Some of them we don't even know, but for some, they are significant persons in their lives.
Your own diocese of Tucson, there down on the border with Mexico, of course, has a very specific mission, particularly with the so many immigrants coming across the border from South America. Could you say something to us about how this perhaps can be part of the new evangelization?
Sure. I think the church must show a solidarity with the poor. One of the things I'll be saying in my intervention is that as bishops, we need to be more regularly and consistently in touch with the migrant, the homeless, people on the margins of life, because that's where the Lord was. He was present with those who were suffering, who needed healing, who needed care, not only physical concerns, but emotional concerns as well. So for us, of course, the issue of immigration remains a very significant issue. Our hope is that some of this will be addressed through government intervention when the election is over, and we can settle down again as a country to be able to focus on how we can address the question of immigration, especially the 12 million or so people that are still in the States who are without documents but living, contributing lives to our community, how we can address that issue. It's a terribly important issue because when people are deported, families are broken up. Some of these young people have never lived in Mexico or Latin America or Central America, and we need to find a way to address this issue. It will take courage, it will take commitment, but it has to be done.
Certainly in the past, the church's voice has come directly into opposition with government policy. The church has been accused of breaking the law. It does take a bold and courageous action on the part of the church. Do you see that as changing at all now?
No, I think at least in the United States, which I can speak best for, our conference has been very united on the issue of immigration and very outspoken on the issue of immigration. And I expect that it will continue to be because it's part of a whole continuum of concerns for the church on the dignity of human life. Sadly, I think for some people there is this tension between pro-life and pro-justice. For a true believer in the Lord, there is no such distinction. We do have to respect the dignity of all human life from conception until natural death. So a pro-immigration Catholic has to be concerned about the unborn, and a person who is concerned for the unborn has to be concerned about people on the margins of life who are living less than decent, respectful lives. So our Catholic teaching, our Catholic social teaching, is a tremendously rich heritage that we have that I hope will continue to live and even live more fully. And maybe the Synod will be an inspiration to stir the embers, as it were, of our social teaching and live it more completely.
If there's one thing that you personally would like to take home with you from this Synod back to your people in Tucson, what would it be?
You know, I was kind of moved the other day when we were reflecting on the 50th anniversary of the Vatican Council, and here we are as bishops gathered for a synod along with lay women and laymen and religious from all over the world. And I couldn't help but think that somehow when the Vatican Council took place, all these people came together and there was a new energy for the church. And I'm afraid we're a little tired now, where we lost some of our confidence, and that perhaps this synod will bring a new fervor to the church and a realization that the church does matter in people's lives. And if we can find more respectful and responsive ways of entering into people's lives, that some great good will happen. I hope in the Diocese of Tucson that this year of faith will awaken people's faith, their relationship with the Lord, rekindle that, redeepen that, that it will help us to discover what in fact the church does teach and how we can teach that more helpful, in a helpful way to people, and that it will be able to inspire others to return. You know, we've lost a lot of people. We miss them, and we hope that they will come home.
My thanks there to Bishop Gerald Kikanis, Chairman of Catholic Relief Services. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme. Join us again at this same time tomorrow or find us on the internet. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.